From the studios at Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines around our area this last week. And today, our panel includes Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and our very own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered right here at Boise State Public Radio. Happy Friday, everybody.
Hi, hey, Gemma. Happy Friday.
Clark, let's begin with you. Earlier this month, a judge here in Idaho signed a death warrant for convicted murderer Thomas Creech. That brought, which was brought up again, the problem that the Department of Correction has had when it comes to finding drugs that it needs to administer lethal injections. However, I know that you found out that the state has those chemicals now. We just don't know where they got them. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Gemma. Yeah, thanks so much. This is an important story, and I'm glad that we get to take a couple of minutes to talk about it. Right off the bat, I want to give a big kudos to reporter Ruth Brown from Idaho Reports and also to Kevin Fixler of the Idaho Statesman. Both of them have done a lot of coverage of the death penalty and sought out a lot of public records. And what I wanted to do with this recent story was just kind of take a step back and look at where we stand today and then kind of examine some of the secrecy that surrounds this process. So let's get into it. But you're absolutely right. For each of the last two legislative sessions, state officials from the Idaho Attorney General's office and from the Idaho Department of Correction have been going to legislators and saying the state has been unable to carry out an execution because the state was unable to obtain the chemicals that are needed for a lethal injection. And these are not chemicals that a pharmacist could, or a doctor or a physician could prescribe to you. They're not regulated by the FDA. And what state officials have said, because of a fear of public backlash, they have not been, the manufacturers and suppliers have not provided them to the state of Idaho. So the state took all these steps over the last 2 years trying to work on that. And so what we saw was last year, the state passed a law adding the firing squad as an alternative method of execution if lethal injection is unavailable. And the year before that, the state passed a law that brings confidentiality into the process of anybody involved with manufacturing, transporting, selling, delivering, testing, or storing lethal injection chemicals. And so you're absolutely right. A couple of weeks ago, the state announced that a judge had signed a death warrant and had scheduled the execution for Thomas Eugene Creech, who's been convicted of murder. And that execution was originally scheduled for next week. It was going to take place on November 8th, but it's been put on hold for a commutation period, for a commutation hearing. And so what I wanted to do is reach out to correction officials and say, where do things stand? And is the state prepared to carry out an execution? They told me that they have obtained chemicals for the lethal injection, but they did not say where they got them, how much they have, who they got them from, how much they paid, or what supply of chemicals they had. I was trying to find out all that information, but that is protected by confidentiality. But the state is prepared to go forward with an injection through lethal injection. I asked about the firing squad facility. That law took effect on July 1, but the state is still in the scoping process leading up to designing a new secure facility where any execution by firing squad would take place. I've been told by Jeff Ray, a public information officer from the Idaho Department of Correction, that there isn't a timeline yet for when the firing squad facility will be completed, but it sounds like it's going to be at least months away, if not a year or more away. So right now, where things stand is the state has obtained chemicals. I tried to ask if what the chemicals were and wasn't able to get an answer. But during the most recent legislative session, a deputy attorney general had told legislators that pentobarbital was the chemical that the state viewed as being viable to carry out an execution. I'm not sure if that's what they've obtained this time most recently, but the state's position had been that pentobarbital was what they believed viable for a lethal injection. That's also what they used in 2012, which was the very last, the most recent time that that Idaho has carried out the death sentence. So it's been more than 11 years since the state has gone through this process, but there are eight inmates on death row in Idaho, Jim, seven men and, mm-hmm. And one woman who have been sentenced to death. And we've seen two of those individuals in the last year have their executions scheduled and a death warrant signed, only to have those either stayed or appealed or gone into a commutation hearing. So it's something that's really picked up activity. I know there was a lot of uncertainty for the last several years about the state's ability to obtain chemicals for a lethal injection and the methods and procedures that they used to do so. We have just a little bit more clarity at this point that the state says it has obtained those chemicals. We don't know much about them or how much they cost or where they came from, but it does look like the state is now able to move forward with an execution. There are appeals and hearings going on, and so nothing is scheduled right now. The one that was scheduled most recently has been put on hold. Just kind of wanted to take a look at where things stand now and remind people what we know and what we don't know about this process with execution and lethal and injection. But I expect that it is something that's going to continue to be in the news. And it sounds like, generally speaking, the Department of Correction is preparing to move forward with executions at some point in the future. And I got a letter that Director Josh Tewalt had sent to the staff. And he said that anybody from the Department of Correction and anybody from the state who would not want to participate and would want to opt out can do so with no repercussions. Mm. They're not going to force anybody in the state to be involved with this. And the message that corrections officials had shared to me is that they don't want to move forward until they're ready and until they can do it with dignity. But I know there's a lot of strong feelings. There's a lot of strong feelings on both sides. During these mm-hmm. hearings in the last year, there was a strong presence from people who are opposed to the death penalty and don't think that taxpayers should be paying for this and think that the process should be more transparent and open. And there are certainly folks on the other side of the debate who have said that the justice process has been playing forward and these individuals have been given a sentence and the state is obligated to carry out that sentence. And so it's a difficult topic. There's a lot of mm-hmm. secrecy surrounding it, but I just kind of wanted to take a step back and sort of analyze where we are right now and what's confidential about the process, because there had been a lot of public discussion about the uncertainty, and it does seem like we're gearing up and preparing to perhaps move forward with an execution at some point. So I just kind of wanted to take a look at where things stand, but there's a lot that we just don't know, Gemma.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for that update, Clark.
You're welcome.
Logan and Troy, can we talk about the Don't Do It Act? Our congressional delegation introduced it last week to try and stop the Lava Ridge Wind Project over in eastern Idaho. So, Troy, can you start and just recap for us what Lava Ridge is?
So Lava Ridge is a gigantic, to be real here, wind energy project in south central Idaho. It would encompass parts of Lincoln and Jerome and Minidoka counties with up to 400 wind turbines. And generally speaking, these are 700 feet tall. They're the large wind turbines. You can see some of them driving through the state already, but this would be a large area, a concentrated area of those meant to generate 1,000 megawatts of power or more that can power around 300,000 homes. The project area, according to the Bureau of Land Management, spans nearly 200,000 acres, but they'd only disturb about 5% of that, around 9,000 acres, with, you know, the infrastructure and the turbines themselves. This has gone through environmental review that just came out. There were thousands of comments submitted on this, but BLM has not released any sort of information about how many of those comments might have been in favor of the project or against it. They're still waiting on the approval process to play out.
So, Logan, Idaho Report sat down with Idaho Senator Jim Risch for your podcast. Why? Tell us why he is opposed to the Lava Ridge project.
Sure. Thanks, Gemma. Yeah, we spoke with U.S. Senator Jim Risch earlier on this week, and he told us that this is one of the very rare issues where pretty much everyone he hears from is agreed. You know, if you're talking about guns or you're talking about abortion or issues in the Middle East, he said usually there's people on either side making arguments, but he's hearing from his constituents in Idaho pretty much unanimous opposition to this project. It would be, like Troy said, a very large project. These wind turbines that are proposed are taller than the Space Needle and would be spread out over a very large geographic area. And so the senator said that what he's hearing from people is this is not what Idahoans want on their public lands in the Magic Valley. And so he has sponsored this piece of legislation called the Don't Do It Act, or Congress sure loves their weird acronyms. Let me make sure I get this right. Don't Develop Obstructive Infrastructure on Our Terrain Act. So that gives you a sense of what we're talking about here. And so this legislation, if it were enacted at the federal level, would basically give state legislatures the ability to, if a state legislature disapproved of one of these energy projects, they could pass a piece of legislation saying we disapprove of this project, and then the federal government would be required not to pursue it anymore. And here in Idaho, our state legislature has already passed something like that. I believe it was a resolution last year expressing disapproval of this project, and so the senator is trying to pass legislation on the federal level that would actually give that a bit of teeth.
Yeah, and counties in the area have expressed their displeasure with similar resolutions as well. And I think it's notable that there are conservation groups that have not come out necessarily in favor of this because of, you know, kind of that slippery slope argument, what it could mean for public lands elsewhere. They're not necessarily against the renewable energy, but they don't necessarily agree with the use of public lands in this way and the potential negative impact on important species in these areas.
Mm-hmm. So Troy, and before we head to break, go ahead, Logan, sorry.
One of the other factors to consider here is the Minidoka National Historic Site, which is a location in Minidoka County where Japanese Americans were interred at this internment camp in World War II. And part of one of the factors about this site is just how remote and somewhat desolate this area of desert is. And so it's a very solemn site. When you're out there and looking out over the vista, you can really imagine yourself being there and imagining what these Japanese Americans felt like as they were forcibly removed from their homes and relocated out to the desert in Idaho. And so a lot of folks who are very protective of that site say that installing all of these massive wind turbines all over the landscape would really disrespect the memory of what occurred out there.
So, Troy, do you think that this Don't Do It Act will actually work?
It certainly could. It would transfer a lot of the power. I think a little bit, in my mind, this is like the ultimate NIMBY legislation, right? Not in my backyard. Mm-hmm. It gives that power to legislators and local lawmakers to block anything that the federal government wants to do on what is notably BLM land. It's intermixed with some Idaho Department of Land, some state land, some private land as well, but predominantly this is federal land. So I think they do think this would work by introducing the legislation. I don't know that it will pass, but if it did, I think it would work. And the implications would obviously go well beyond this particular project, because this would then apply across the country.
Troy, it is really kind of unfathomable to think that November 13th, so a week from Monday, will be the one-year anniversary of the murder of four University of Idaho students that were killed in an off-campus house in Moscow. So Troy, some new developments this last week, and that is that the FBI went back to the house on King Road where these killings took place. Can you tell us why and what's going on?
Yeah, so the house was already cleared for demolition by both the mm-hmm. prosecutors and defense in this case. They said they had no objections to it. The residence was donated to the university by the landlord. The university planned to knock it down. Those plans were paused due to opposition from at least one of the families. Kaylee Gonzalez's family thought that it should not be demolished before the trial had a chance to proceed. With suspect Brian Koberger having waived his right to a speedy trial, there is no timeline right now for when the trial may commence. And so this has presented the prosecution and the FBI with an opportunity to go back into the home. And in a news release from the University of Idaho explaining this, they say that the prosecutors want to be able to build a more thorough model and do some video and audio models from inside the residence to make sure that they have those things squared away. So it doesn't sound like they're necessarily looking for any new evidence, but they are trying to dot those I's and cross those T's, perhaps, on exactly what may have happened and how the residence itself may have played into the movements of the suspect or the victims in this case.
So at this point then, Troy, that has impacted, as you mentioned, the trial date. So that's now up in the air.
Yeah, there is no trial date at this time.
Okay.
And there are some other hearings in between dealing with the use of evidence. The judge in the case recently ruled that he would continue to permit video cameras in the courtroom, but that's kind of to his discretion as things go along. Mm-hmm. And there are other challenges to the way prosecutors have used DNA linking from evidence gathered at the scene to link to the suspect, Brian Koberger. So there's no trial date set specifically yet. There are ongoing hearings in this. The university still intends to knock down the house, but mm-hmm. they say that will not happen. In their news release, they said it would not happen this semester. I think it's fair to say that the trial process is going to go on much longer than that. And the families have since come out and said that they don't support demolition until the trial is complete.
And we should note that students are planning a vigil on Monday night, November 13th, in Moscow to remember the students who were killed. And they're also asking that all vandals everywhere are being asked to turn on their porch lights from 7 to 8 p.m. Mountain Standard Time to honor their memories. So that's, again, November 13th. Clark, shifting gears, lawmakers, they are back in Boise, even though it is a couple months until our next legislative session starts. And I know you've been keeping an eye on them, including the budget writing committee. Why is JFAC looking at state budgets right now instead of waiting until January?
Yeah, it's something that they've done to get geared up for the upcoming legislative session, which you mentioned is going to kick off in January. I want to say it's January 8th that it kicks off with the governor's State of the State address. But I talked with Representative Wendy Horman. She's a Republican from Idaho Falls who serves as a co-chair on JFAC, and she's been on JFAC for years and years now. And she told me that it really only took her 1 year to realize that January is much too late to start on the budget setting process. And so in terms of the timeline, the state agencies have actually submitted their proposed budgets for next year. They submitted those back on September 1st. And so those are already available. And what JFAC members are going to be doing is they're going to spend 3 days at the Idaho State Capitol in Boise next week. They're going to be starting to go through and look at what some of these budget requests are and begin looking at the numbers and crunching the numbers and looking at their revenues so that they can be ready to go in January. They're not going to vote on budgets next week. They're not going to set dollar amounts. That work will still happen during the legislative session, but it's a chance to get geared up for the session ahead. JFAC, I talked about this a year ago on the show, but JFAC is under new leadership in the last year, and more than half of the members on JFAC are new. This is a powerful committee. They write each element of the state's budget. And so there's going to be a number of changes that we're expecting for next year. The JFAC's kind of moving into the 21st century. They're going to be more of a digital committee, relying on devices like iPads and Surfaces rather than carrying around the physical budget books. They're going to be looking at accountability audits and having that play more of a role in the budget and accountability process. And I think they're going to be breaking into smaller working groups and taking on budgets in smaller teams. And those meetings are maybe going to look differently this next legislative session than they have over the last 10 years. And so next week, we're going to get some more insight into how that's going to work during the session. And I'm going to do some more reporting about some of these changes and what folks can expect. But it's really about getting geared up for the session that kicks off in January. There were some other meetings this week. There was a leadership meeting yesterday. But really, the activity all around the state capitol building is starting to pick up, and those halls are going to be busy for sure come January. But this is all part of the lead up and getting familiar with that budget, because the budget really drives the length of the session. And what we've seen is all these budgets coming forward at the very end of the session. And so I think legislators want to make a little bit more progress earlier in the session. And I'm just kind of interested in some of these changes, how they're going to work and how they're going to affect the meeting structure. So I'll be at those meetings next week. There's also a field trip planned. JFAC members are going to visit the prison and maybe a couple of other sites. And so I'm hoping to go out in the field on Thursday for their tour too, and just kind of report on what the legislators are up to and what changes are planned for next year. But it's going to be an important session. And we already know next year is an election year, so there's going to be a lot going on for us to keep track of, Gemma.
Oh, absolutely. So, Logan, Idaho Reports had a story this week about a lawsuit filed by some state agencies over a new law that keeps them from making new rules without the legislature's permission. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure, Gemma. So if we think back to kind of our Civics 101, the lawmaking body, the legislature, the legislative branch writes the laws, and then the executive branch, which is headed by the governor, carries them out. So the laws are supposed to kind of set the general policy, and then if there's more specifics, then state agencies are empowered to write rules about them. So for example, think of like a state law that would say septic tanks aren't allowed to pollute drinking water sources. Well, it's very hard to change a law, so it's doesn't really make sense to put like the standards that septic tanks have to be built to in the state law. So that stuff is kind of more flexible. And so that's the type of thing that the Department of Environmental Quality would write. And so the for the last, I don't know how long, but for the time being, the administrative rules have been something that the lawmakers want to make sure that the agencies are being faithful to the intent of the law and are writing rules that make sense and aren't overly burdensome for Idahoans. And so they take several weeks, typically at the beginning of each legislative session, reviewing all of these rules. And they have the ability to, if the lawmakers do not like rules that an agency has written or think that they are inappropriate or no longer relevant, the House and Senate can agree to strike those rules. However, they have not officially approved the body of rules for the last several years. I believe it's been since 2019 that the legislature has neglected to pass what sometimes was called the going home bill. It was often the very last thing they would do at the end of session is approve the rules for the year. And so in that 2019 to 2020 cycle, the entire body of administrative rules expired, and Governor Little had to direct the agencies to put forward temporary rules in their place so that the rules still existed. And so the legislature, it takes a lot of time and a lot of manpower for them to go through and review every single rule that every single agency has written. I mean, it's we're talking about so many things, all the way from what you're allowed to do if you're released out on parole, to the fish and game licensing and rules about where and when you're allowed to feed wildlife. It really covers the whole gamut of pretty much about just about everything state government does. So this last year, the legislature passed a law that set up kind of a rotating review cycle for these rules, so that rather than reviewing all of the rules every single year, it was supposed to set up this kind of 8-year time cycle for review. So they would be reviewing small pieces of the rules every 8 years. But another detail in that bill is that the lawmakers did not want rules to go into effect until they were approved. And so this gets into the issue that this legal complaint is about. So in the past, it would be lawmakers would write a law, and in that law, they would give an agency the ability to write rules to make sure it was implemented. And then they would come back and review and strike them out, et cetera, like we've been talking. However, now under this legislation, these agencies say that it precludes them from implementing rules at all until the lawmakers approve them. Specifically, this complaint was made by the State Athletic Commission. So they regulate things like boxing matches, for example. They write rules about like weight classes and, you know, you're not allowed to have weighted gloves in a boxing match and things like that. And so this is kind of an obscure agency that I wasn't necessarily aware of. But basically how this played out is the legislature did not take up or approve the Athletic Commission's rules in the last legislative session before they adjourned. And so their rules expired, and without the ability to get lawmakers to sign off on any new rules because they're not in session, the State Athletic Commission says they don't have any enforceable rules right now. And so this this complaint that was filed with the Idaho Supreme Court says that this is a violation of separation of powers, where if the legislature wants to do something, they have to pass a law and get it through both bodies and get the governor's signature or overturn a veto. And so they're really, the agencies are arguing that the legislature is overstepping its authority and kind of getting into the micromanaging of the writing and approving of these rules.
All right. Well, thanks for that update on that. That's really interesting. So, Troy, we are just a couple of ways away from Election Day, and there are all kinds of bonds on the ballots around the state. I know we've focused on the jail expansion bond in Ada County earlier this week. However, I want you to tell us about the EMS bond that will be on the ballot in Valley County. So there are two things to vote on this, correct?
Yeah, one is the structure that they'll be implementing, or that they'd like to implement, and the other is the way to pay for it. And it's a pretty significant tax hike, because officials there and first responders say there's a lot of work to do. The current structure was kind of based on, you know, a quiet, sleepy county, right? And you have this area with not a lot of residents, and they had a fair amount of volunteers over the years that could serve as first responders. Well, that, as we all know, has changed pretty dramatically. Population is up, visitation is up, the calls for help are also up, and the funding hasn't kept pace. And so the way funding works up there is EMS services are contracted through each individual fire district. So you have the Donnelly Protection Fire District, Cascade, McCall as well. And each one of these organizations contracts for EMS service, and they've had to supplement, to make EMS services happen, they've had to supplement those emergency medical response budgets with some money from their fire budgets. And the county has chipped in as well with some of its general revenue too, to make this all kind of work. But that's not necessarily a sustainable model. And so what they're asking for is to take the current structure and dissolve it and create an independent EMS commission that would be countywide. It would come with its own 3-member volunteer board. And so the county commissioners would no longer have oversight, direct oversight of the EMS commission, but they would appoint the volunteer members of this board. And then the new taxing district that would come with it, it's technically, it's an override levy. The current levy rate for folks in Valley County for EMS services is $12, roughly $12 per $100,000 of taxable property value. That would jump to about $40 of per $100,000. So that's more than tripling. And what the county wants to do with this money is put a professionally staffed full-time ambulance in each major city in the county, Donnelly, McCall, Cascade, and then have a fourth that can support if one of those other units is out on a call, or say in Yellow Pine, where you might have a 6-hour round trip call for somebody needing help out there, you'd have a fourth EMS unit serving as backup to respond to things in Cascade while the other unit's away. The trick with this is that they needed, by state statute, they needed a ballot issue to dissolve and reorganize, which requires a simple majority. And for the levy override, they need a supermajority. And so that's why it's these two separate issues that voters will see on their ballots.
So, Troy, is it true that that our state doesn't consider EMS services to be essential?
Yes, and that's gotten, I'd say, a significant amount of attention over the last year or year and a half from folks at Boise State Public Radio, from folks at public television I know have reported on it, The Statesman, I think, as well. And there is a push from first responders and advocacy groups across the state to change this. They are working cautiously. As some might say, they're working very carefully to get this, the legislative support it needs to be changed. There is a working group that was formed earlier this year that is going to try to get this done legislatively. But yeah, that remains the case, that they are not considered essential by the state.
So Logan and Clark, both of you jump in here because you both, I believe, spoke with Division of Financial Management Administrator Alex Adams. Logan, you spoke to him about your podcast, about how Idaho is doing financially, and we are down by $39 million. So, should taxpayers be concerned about this?
It's early in the fiscal year, Gemma. And so, I think the question is, we don't know yet, or I don't know yet, would be maybe the way that I would respond to this. There has been a lot of uncertainty over where state revenues stand the last 3 months because of the state transitioning to this new business system that affects all state agencies, and the state not being able to put out on time the official comparative revenue report that legislators and the public use to track these things. I got a little bit of an update on revenues yesterday at a meeting that I was at the state capitol building. But Idaho runs on a fiscal year calendar, and it goes from July 1st to June 30th every year. Mm-hmm. And so we're a little over 3 months into the fiscal year at this point, and revenues look to be down, but it also appears to me that we have not officially accounted for all the different revenue sources. I also know that revenues were down early last year in the fiscal year, and the state rebounded and did not run a deficit. I know it's going to be on legislators' radar. I know that Speaker of the House Mike Moyle, the highest ranking member of the Idaho House, was complaining about the revenue reports and this LUMA business system yesterday during a public meeting. Speaker Moyle said, "We don't know what our revenues are for the first quarter, and that's a joke," is what the Speaker of the House said. But I did get a report back in October that showed revenues were down more than $30 million when you look at the three largest revenue sources. Yesterday's update was that revenues appear to be leveling out a little bit more, but it appears to me that all of the revenues, particularly like some miscellaneous revenue sources, have not been calculated at this point. I know it's going to be on legislators' radar, and I know I'm going to try and dig in more, and I know Logan will as well, but I'm not sure if what Logan's been able to uncover, but I'll let Logan talk about his perspective for a second. But it's certainly something I'm going to be keeping an eye on and trying to find more information about, Gemma.
Mm-hmm. So Logan, your thoughts on this? I mean, were analysts expecting revenue to drop?
Sure. When I spoke with Alex Adams last week, he's the head of the Division of Financial Management, which is basically the governor's budgeting agency. He said that, yes, this was somewhat expected. You know, there's been a lot of money kind of sloshing around in the economy since the COVID relief and the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, funding was made available. And so he said the state has been kind of anticipating this. They used a lot of that one-time federal money to pay off one-time expenses, things like replacing outdated bridges and whatnot. And so he told me, though, that this first quarter, this $39 million figure that we came in under projection, he and his agency are not too worried about it. He said that often at this point in that yearly cycle, it's not too unexpected to be under, just because of how the different forms of revenue come in. You know, you pay your sales tax 6 cents on the dollar every time you go to the cash register, mm-hmm. but you only pay your income taxes once a year. So depending on what month these different payments are coming in, that can really sway how the numbers look month to month. However, he did also tell me that if this $39 million shortfall in the first quarter carried through for the rest of the year, because of how conservatively the state budgets, even if the revenue shortfalls continued, we would still at the end of the year have a balance of about $280 million on the ledger. So he said that's about a 5% cushion, even if this roughly $40 million short each quarter carried through. And on top of that, the state also has about $1.2 billion in rainy day funds. So think of that almost as like a savings account if there were, say, another recession or housing crash like we mm-hmm. saw in 2008 that really tanked the state government's ability to pay for things. The state does have over $1 billion in rainy day funds that they could use to weather a downturn.
Well, I want to thank all of you so much for taking time out of your busy schedules to talk with us and get us up to date. A lot happening this last week. So a big thank you to Clark Corbin with Idaho Capital Sun, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Troy Offie, host of All Things Considered with Boise State Public Radio News. Thank you all so much.
Thanks, Jim. Welcome, Jim. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is my voice. It can tell you a lot about me, and I'm not changing it for anyone. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of NPR episodes centered on the Black experience. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get podcasts.